This is August 21st, 2003, and I'm Calder Pickett, and it's my pleasure today to interview a man who really gave me a lot of help over the years when he was over in university archives providing material for me about the different people being interviewed. In fact, I have some stuff here that Barry looked up about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use that as part of the background. I said, for example, my learning that you, of all things, were an MU man.
Yes, I was.
Well, there are a few of them around here. You know, that, my friend Tom Evelyn is one of
yes,
them.
Yes, I know Tom very well
and,
indeed.
Chuck Woodling down at the Journal World is an MU man, and
yep.
Who was probably a much bigger booster of KU than of MU, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Way I talked with him.
Yeah, Chuck was my old boss down there for, you know, when we were, for 10 years when we did the outdoor page down there.
Oh, did you do that through
yeah,
him?
Yeah.
Well, he used to set me up every morning with on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really good guy.
He's a nice man.
Oh, yeah.
He's tremendous.
And he's a very literate, intelligent man. He's not just a hack sports writer who knows only sports. He can talk with you about all kinds
yes,
of stuff.
He can.
That's what makes him a good man, I think. Ned, I would like you to start with some kind of basic material about yourself. To tell us your date of birth, your place of birth, and then tell us the names of your parents and what your father did for a living and so on to get us started here.
Sure. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri on April 27, 1940 at St. Mary's Hospital, and my mother and father were actually in the restaurant business. My father for a while worked for Southwestern Bell, and they went to school at the University of Washington, Washington University in St. Louis. And, in 1947, we moved from Webster Groves, which was a suburb of St. Louis, to Sedalia, Missouri.
Your parents were college people.
College people, yes, they were.
Well, that's a rarity.
That's
among the people I've been interviewing frequently, the parents went through the eighth grade or something
mm-hmm.
like that, but.
They grew up in a more urban environment too, you know, and so that may be a little bit different. And my grandfather Garstang was a lawyer, which was my mother's father, and so you know they were on that track. All of his kids went to college. All of my grandfather's children, he had three of them. One went to the University of Illinois, one went to Westminster, and then went to law school at Washington University in St. Louis. And
now, what did you say your father's name was?
My grandfather's name was James Garstang, and he was a lawyer in St. Louis. He died in 1948. He actually died in a courtroom of a heart attack. He's massive, you know, he's one of those typical kind of H.L. Mencken-looking guys with a big cigar and a bucket of beer type
yeah.
thing, you know, and... After my grandmother died in 1942, he moved in with us. My grandmother died of a black widow bite, actually.
And now, did you live with your grandparents?
No, we didn't, but my grandfather moved in our house in Webster Groves after his wife died. And
well,
so,
I'm still not sure I got what your father's name was.
Oh, my father's name was Edward.
Edward
Cady.
Well, that's
my name too. Yeah,
that's your name
yes,
too.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I was named
yeah.
after him.
But
Edward G. And my actually G was for Gustav. My father was from German heritage. And my grandfather moved over, he dropped Gustav and was just Edward G. Period.
Now this is a German name.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cady
okay.
is a German name.
I'm wondering.
Name.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. How come Ned instead of Ed?
Well, just to keep me from, so I would be distinguished from my father when, you know, my mother would yell Ned, he would know that she was dealing with me rather than with my father.
When I first went through the list of retirees, I guess my eye slipped right over your name because I wasn't looking for an Edward, and
right.
And so I was a little startled
yeah.
at that point. In St. Louis, so you were a city boy.
City boy till 1947, and then 1947, we moved to Sedalia, It was right. That was a year after my grandmother died and my grandfather died.
So he's seven years old.
Right.
Do you have many memories of St. Louis?
Oh, quite a few. Yes, yeah. And they were reinforced because we used to go back with astonishing regularity. You know, every 2 or 3 weeks. Because my father's mother, or my grandmother, still lived in St. Louis. She lived till she was 98.
Did you live near the river?
No, we lived quite a ways. We lived in Webster Groves, which is
Webster Groves. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, did you ever go fishing in the river?
No, but my grandfather took us to Venice. My grandfather, in fact, I just finished the story. I work for the Topeka paper now, so I just finished the story because we just got back from Minnesota. My grandfather started going to Minnesota in 1935, and almost with astonishing regularity from August of 1935 to 2003, a member of our clan has been to Minnesota, and so that's where I really started. Got the fishing fever, and I have a pretty severe case of it.
You're talking just a little fast.
Okay.
You know, I'd like you to slow down.
All right, sure.
I'm just wondering whether you were like the young Sam Clemens.
Sam Clemens. I wish I was. I'm actually rereading The Adventures of Mark Twain right now.
Oh, are you?
It's always I try to reread it once every 10 years.
Oh,
or so.
Yeah.
It's a delightful book.
I've done a lot with him. This is something that fascinates me. The Mississippi River, every time we get near there, it just excites me. Years ago, we drove up to the overlooking Hannibal,
mm-hmm.
overlooking the Mississippi, and boy, I was wishing that a steamboat would come along there, and I also got to wishing that instead of doing a radio program, that I was doing television, because I could move around there and get pictures of all of the Mark Twain stuff and maybe even see a steamboat, you know, and maybe hear a steamboat, I don't know. But I was just reading recently that up until the time of Mark Twain that America's great river was the Hudson because of Washington Irving.
Sure.
But when Mark Twain came along, it became the Mississippi, and it has been the Mississippi ever since.
That Hudson's a beautiful river, though.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is.
It's because we have a daughter that lives in Brooklyn, and every year we take the train from Lawrence, and at 6 o'clock in the morning we get off in New York City, and we just go down the eastern shore of the Hudson. It's really a great valley to go through. It's just exciting as the Dickens to.
Were there any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother John, and John actually took over my parents' restaurant business in Sedalia, and he and his son now do that business.
Why did they move to Sedalia?
My father was working at the same time for Southwestern Bell, and they transferred him then. So they sold their restaurant business in St. Louis that they had, and moved to St. Louis, and slowly about 1947, and by 1952 they had opened another restaurant, and my father quit working for Southwestern Bell and just went into the full time in the restaurant business.
Yeah, you're one of the guys, one of the young guys I'm interviewing now. People, I can't very well ask you about the Great Depression, maybe I can ask you about World War II. I don't know. You're going to have some.
I had some recollections. I can mainly remember the day that Roosevelt died, and I can remember, I think I can remember the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I think I can, you know. I don't know if I've recreated that in my mind or what. But the main thing I can remember is when Roosevelt died. I can remember people honking horns after one period, and I keep on thinking that could have been the end of the war in Europe, but I just can't quite remember.
Yeah, and lots of things that we remember are things that our parents have told us,
mm-hmm.
and I keep wondering whether I have a memory of some of these things about the Depression, World War II, or whether it's just something that I've gleaned out of the reading that
mm-hmm.
I've done,
sure.
the writing I've done. But
my wife, there are
some memories.
Yeah, my wife is such a World War II and Winston Churchill buff that she talks about the World War II. We talk about it on a daily basis almost. So I can't. I don't know what I know. Most of what I know about World War II comes from my wife, because she's absolutely a ravenous reader about it.
Were your parents fairly well off, Ned?
They were fairly well. They were middle class folks. and middle class. And you know, I was for the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then my brother came into business with him in 1970, and we went through that period of kind of economic woes in the 70s, and they tried to incorporate my brother in the business, and it really got to be very hard. They were all of them were hard pressed there for the
Did you ever have to go to work when you were a boy?
Oh yeah. I worked as a fishing guide in Minnesota from 1953 to 1960, and then I started as a fishing guide when I was 13, and I worked until my second year in college.
What kind of fish do you catch? The Mississippi catfish?
Catfish, right in that part of Mississippi. In
fact, catfish are mighty good fish.
Mighty good fish. There's been a resurgence, kind of a renaissance in catfish here in the last. I'm a field editor for a big fishing magazine called In Fisherman. Since I live here, I'm the only guy that lives in the heart of catfish land. Most of my writing on the national front is about catfish.
Yeah, I want to talk with you a bit more later, after we get you out of your
youth,
out of your childhood.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Tell me about your home life. Did you have books and magazines and by that time
Television. We had our first television in 1956.
Not until 56. Yeah, we got our first one here in 52. They just hadn't existed where we'd been before.
Yeah, some people in Sedalia had one probably by 52 also, but the reception was so poor because it's in the center of the state, and Kansas City was the venue that we had. My father was frugal. It was a frugal German too, and it was took a lot of probably convincing on my brothers on my part to have him get one.
Did your parents encourage you to get an education, be interested in education?
Yeah, they did. They were, not fever, and they weren't feverish about it, but my mother was more feverish about it than my father. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of...
You probably started school in Webster Groves.
Webster Groves in kindergarten, yes.
And then moved to Sedalia.
Second grade.
Yeah. So did you go clear through high school?
I went through high school in Sedalia.
Were you a good student?
No, I'm always been a mediocre student. I suffer from dyslexia. It's a terrible case of dyslexia, which I've kind of I've kind of conquered a little bit, But it was a tough go in a way, I guess. I wasn't really aware of it, never aware of it, but I didn't know it was dyslexia till a long time. But
I never heard of it when I was a boy growing up.
Me either.
Now maybe that existed before some of the children in our school, but I don't have any memories of that.
Yeah, and I didn't even know what I had. But I was a C student back in those days.
What did you like? What did you like?
I was history.
History.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I had a great high school teacher. Two of them in history. Hazel Gray was just a charming woman and delight. Like most teachers in those days, she wasn't married and forever and ever, but she just had a way with children, she was our high school history teacher and social studies teacher and stuff like this, and she just was one of those people that had the charisma and ability to really get you energized and enthralled. So that was the courses I would make A's in, would be that one. And I had another one, Mr. Owens, Jim Owens, and he introduced me to H.L. Mencken, and that was a great revelation in my life to be introduced to H.L. Mencken when I was a junior in high school.
Really, that young?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think that I was conscious of him until my college year.
Yeah, but we had old Alistair Cook published those right at that time. Alistair Cook published those Mencken essays and stuff, and so it was really kind of that was just what came got on our reading list at that time. It was one of those things must have been. So, and I just he was such a character that he kind of appealed to me, that iconoclastic nature of old Mencken. And I suffer from a terrible case of, I'm kind of a cynic in a way, in a terrible sense. So it appealed to me, very well, really appealed to me.
Well, you can both like and dislike H.L. Mencken.
Oh, yes.
You can like the way he wrote and the things he said, but then when you hear about some of his views,
sure.
he was practically a Nazi in World War
sure.
II.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And for that matter, he was very pro-German in World War One, and of course, a great many people were. I interested in your Germanic background because my mother she was in a German family. In fact, when she used to get mad at us sometimes, she'd swear in German, and I didn't know what it meant, but that was clearly in the background that I had too. You graduated in what year? From
58.
1958. So by your age, you had nothing to do with the war in Korea either.
In Vietnam. I was one of those very fortunate people in a way. That was a thing you look back on in life and say, boy, I missed that, because John Nugent, my colleague, you know, he was a World War II veteran, and I missed all that because I don't get to tell those great war tales that he told, you know. And so I was 1A all my life. I never had to worry. I was 1A, and I never got drafted because it was just one of those oddities of life.
I will carry to the day I die the fact that I went into service and was discharged after a short time because my left ear was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
The hearing was so bad, and all of my friends were in the service, and I had this. I really thought about this recently in the Bob Dole stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the. To the cemeteries up there above the D-Day beaches,
mm-hmm.
and the Omaha Beach Cemetery. I walked along there looking at the at the gravestones,
mm-hmm.
and reading the names and the ages, and I started to bawl.
Yep.
Because these guys were, so many of them were my age.
Yep.
1921.
Mm-hmm.
And it just something that, you know, really, yep. really gets you. And also the fact that my wife was in the Waves.
No.
She was a veteran in our family. Graduated in 1958. What did you do then, Ned?
Then I went to, I had aspirations to be a baseball player too. And either fishing and baseball were my two passions.
Well, now what rivers that in Sedalia?
We were right adjacent to the Lake of the Ozarks.
Okay, okay.
So, and that was the Osage River. And so I fished all the way through that area. You know, We'd even sneak out of school and go fishing. A friend of mine, Leland Payton, we went fishing incessantly. You know, it was just, we went to creeks, and we rode our bicycles when I was a kid, you know, in the early 50s, miles to go fishing. And it's just one of those terrible passions that afflicts you, and you don't know why.
Well, had you been good in sports in high school?
I always good. I played sports, all sports in high school, and I wanted to be a baseball player, and I went to the University of Missouri, and played freshman baseball there, and my roommate Art Shamsky came up to Topeka, and we were both going to try out for the Cincinnati Reds. He got picked up for the Reds and actually ended up playing in the 69 World Series with the Mets.
Were you a St. Louis Cardinal?
Oh, I was unbelievable. Harry Carey, I grew up with Harry Carey. In fact, my father went to school with Harry Carey. Remember Harry Carey, the St. Louis Cardinal broadcaster, then went on to be it for the Cubs. But my dad and Harry Carey were in the same class all the way in Webster Groves from kindergarten to their senior year in high school.
You know, the Cardinals and the Cubs are
right.
They're America's teams.
Team. Mm-hmm.
I think people throughout the land have that feeling about both of them, and some of the people who were playing for the Cardinals back in those days. I know when I was growing up,
sure.
they were frequently in the World Series and so on. Yeah,
I can remember the first time my father took me to a game. I used to listen to Harry Carey. I'd go to bed at night with the radio on, listening to Harry, and Harry has a son the same age as I am named Skip. Skip broadcasts for the Atlanta Braves. He still does. And he'd always say, "Good night, Skip," about the fifth inning, you know, and that's about the same time I'd pass out, too. And my dad took me to the first game of my life, and I said, this is not as interesting as listening to Harry broadcast it, because Harry was just... For me, it was just he made the game better than it was. You know, he's like a great writer.
Harry had some illness that was toward the end of his life, and our daughter lives in Chicago, and she lived very near Wrigley Field,
mm-hmm.
and we went to the game the day that Harry Carey returned from his illness,
mm-hmm.
and got up there and let everybody in singing "Take Me Out" the ball game and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now this is kind of off the subject. I mean, I got you off it. You were thinking you might become a baseball.
Yeah, well, I had aspirations of that way, but I wasn't good enough, you know. So I went to MU for a year. I left with a friend, my friend Leland Payton, who was going to KU, and we went to Mexico for 6 months. And after 6 months, we went to Aspen. We were living in Aspen and helped build a ski lift up the western slope out there. I was kind of a trout bum out there.
You were doing this just as a young guy?
Yes, as a young guy, yeah. We were just kind of trout bums and ski bums at that time, you know. And we were 18, 19 years old. That was the first time. That was my only, I never had any rebellion against my parents. My parents and I had an idyllic relationship. We never... I can't remember a cross word ever said, but I told my parents since I didn't make this ball club thing that Shansky make, I just quit school and went to Mexico with my.
What'd you do in Mexico?
My friend was an artist and photographer, and we just had aspirations of being some sort of bohemian type of ordeal, and we just lollygagged around, and that's.
Did you stay mainly in one place?
Or? Yeah, we stayed primarily in Mexico City.
Uh-huh.
And,
okay.
And then we came home. We hitchhiked down there, actually. I can imagine my mother and father were just absolutely petrified.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's still afraid to go to Mexico because he still thinks that the banditos he saw in the trade of Sierra Madre are going to rush it.
Well, it could be right.
You think about stuff like that.
Sure.
We found Mexico City an extremely civilized and pleasant city.
It is a great place.
Yeah.
It is a great
beautiful place. City, too, when there's not a lot of smoke.
Yes, it is. It's a charming place. It really is.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, I was naive and young, and I really didn't know what I was doing. But we just did it because it was, we were kind of influenced by Jack Kerouac at that time and that stuff. So
hey, were you really?
Yeah, so, you know, that was just the year of Jack Kerouac in that 58, 60, and. So, you know, and Leland was an art student up here at KU, and the art students were all, I had a propensity to be old bohemians anyway, you know, so I picked up on that kind of after that way. And then I came to KU the next year, and I went to school here at KU.
Now, did you ever get mixed up in the beatniks?
No, I didn't. I came up here and enrolled in history up here at KU. It probably doesn't reflect that on there, because I didn't graduate from here. With a BA degree.
You came here, now you said?
I came here in 60, and I left here in 63, I think. And
why'd you come here?
Because Leland was here, my friend, and I came here, and I just enrolled in history, and I became a mentor. Actually, Cliff Griffin was, he was one of his first years there, and he was one tremendous lecturer. One unbelievable lecture. I took History 5 from him, and the first day people were applauding. Kids stood up in the class and applauded, and I just couldn't understand. You know, I thought he was a great lecturer, but my goodness gracious, he was. You know, and then as I kept on listening, I was cynical at that time. I didn't, and he was a terrible cynic too. You know, he was just a Cliff. Cliff taught me to reinforce my bad habits of being cynical and critical.
We never could get Cliff to
give an oral
participate
history.
In this.
Yeah.
No, I don't know why.
Because
he had a story.
Yes, he did.
Anyway.
And Cliff was a cynic, and I think he had battled the bottle a little bit, to tell you the truth, you know. But he was a very good, great mentor. He taught me a lot about writing and helped me with my dyslexia a lot. And, you know, he was just a... He was a very helpful person for me. Yeah, I used to dread turning a paper into him because it would come back just looking like blood, because he would just write the dickens out of it.
Where did you live when you were here?
I lived up 1237 Orient, right where the parking lot is.
Live in an apartment?
Yeah, it was an apartment there. It's right next. It was right next to the Roberto's Pizza. Remember Roberto's Pizza thing? And it became the Gaslight. It went back in the troubled years. You know, it was a there was a barber shop, and then there was Edmonton Bookshop was in there too. And then we lived upstairs. There were two areas of apartments there. Lived with a guy named Mike Carmichael, whose father was a physician at the Med Center in Kansas City. And Mike had come here from, he was transferred here from Dartmouth. Mike was a philosophy student, and he ended up going to the Med Center. Mike was a tremendous drawer of fish. He worked for Frank Cross. The Fishes of Kansas are littered with that book, Fishes of Kansas.
Have you ever tried to mount any?
No, I never have.
Yeah.
Never have. You know,
my niece's husband does that. He mounts them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out west for a family reunion a number of years ago, and my grandson caught they had a little fishing pond there, and easy to catch fish, of course, out of it. But he caught this beautiful trout, and Sid took it back to Salt Lake City and mounted it for him, and boy, is my grandson proud.
I bet you.
Oh, yeah, that fish is mounted there on the wall.
Oh, that's nice.
Know,
yes.
I took pictures of his holding the fish.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
Now, after you were here, you went to Central Missouri State. Where's that?
That's in Warrensburg. Yeah, that's right near Sedalia.
Why'd you go there?
Well, I decided to try to get a teaching degree, and that was a kind of a teaching school, and it was a mistake, essentially. I wasn't suited to be a teacher, essentially, a high school teacher, but I got a teaching degree, and I don't remember what year that was, about 1965, maybe?
Well, 65 is when having the degree, the BA degree.
Right, then I went to University of Missouri after that.
It was just logical, I guess, for you to go to Missouri.
Right.
This is your
home state.
Your home country.
Right.
And so on.
You know.
And you went there. Now, were you a better student, Ned, than you'd been previously?
Yes. A much more serious student. And Cliff Griffin made me a serious student. You know, he was a tough taskmaster, you know. And so I think Cliff taught me a lot. And he's been up until the day he died. He was very supportive, and you know he would read a lot of essays I would write in the newspaper, and always you know write me back and say things to me and call me up. So I had a very close relationship to him.
Did you have a thesis?
No, I didn't. I didn't write a thesis. We had an option, either thesis or non-thesis. I thought about going and getting a PhD, but that was just during the period of. When it was the economy was going to hell in a handbasket for PhDs in history, and I wisely decided, I guess, I got hired at the library. That's what happened. The librarian asked me if I wanted to be a librarian, and I said, yeah, I'll be one. It was just one of those serendipitous things of life, that's how I got in the library world.
I used to tell students when they were in a kind of floundering mood, kind of like that boy in The Graduate.
Mm-hmm.
That what they should do is get their bachelor's degree in some strong program such as history or political science, and then come over to the School of Journalism,
sure,
where they could get a master's degree and get a job.
Job.
Because that, of course, is a problem, I'm mm-hmm. sure, for a person who gets a degree in. Oh, and I would suppose many of the the liberal arts.
Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, and. Got you interested in library. How did you get interested in that, do you think? What was there about library that appealed to you?
Well, I was working. I was doing a paper for Lewis Atherton, who was a fairly renowned trans-Mississippi West historian.
What was his name?
Lewis Atherton. He wrote a bunch of histories about small towns in the middle border, I was working pretty hard in the library, and then in the Missouri Historical Society, and the dean, not the dean, what the head of the library at MU was a University of Texas graduate in history. He didn't have a library degree either, and he had an opening. That library was divided, and they had a journalism library, they had a history library, it was a departmentalized thing. He said he didn't have a hard time pronouncing my name. He said, Mr. Keeney, he said, how would you like to work up there in the library for me? And I said, well, yeah, I'll do that. So I got it. I became a librarian, and I was, that was about 67. He hired me.
Hey, did you ever know Bill Taft over there in the School of Journalism?
Journalism, yes, sure.
William Howard Taft.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A good friend of mine.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He and I worked together for years and things. And in fact, when I got some national award, I think it was for my Ed Howe book, Bill came over here for the program. He and I always got together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of off the subject.
Sure.
I just kind of...
Yeah, he's a good...
Interested.
Yeah. Is he still alive?
I think he is. Mm-hmm. Somebody told me not too long ago, I think it was Tom Eblen, told me that Bill Taft had been asking about me.
Oh, really?
We used to always talk about going over to Kansas City with our wives and having dinner and so on. And I don't think we ever did it. I saw him at national meetings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the other people, you know, over there. The great journalism historian, Frank Luther Mott.
Yeah, sure.
He and I became very good friends, too.
I'm sure, I can imagine that. Yes.
Yeah. He used to write to me. And for me, that was a real honor to have an association with a man like Frank Luther Mott. Mm-hmm. He was probably the best journalism historian in America at that time.
And John Breed, just being a colleague of John Bremner, was a hell of an honor too, though, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I always liked Bremner. I love that his archives are up there, and just looking through his data analysis of the New York Times, you know, God dang, how can a guy be so... see all that great, how can he see it? It just blows me away how good he was at seeing stuff like that. He was just an amazing guy on that stuff.
So you stayed there at MU and got your degree in library science
eventually.
You married?
Yes, I was married. I actually, what happened was in 1970 we got a new librarian. The old librarian that hired me left, retired, and they got a new guy in, and he was a heavy duty professional librarian, and I didn't have a library degree, so he said, you know, and I didn't think I needed to have a library degree, because I'm a negative type of guy a lot of ways. So I said, no, I don't need one. I'm just doing fine here, and they did a fine job before. Why do I need one? And he said, well, if you're not going to get one, I'm firing you. So they fired me. And my wife was actually getting a degree in library science, and she got a job here at KU, and I came here on her shoestrings.
Her name was Pat?
No, I was married before. Her name was Martha, and Martha and I were married for 20 years, and then she left and went to Mexico and decided to never come back. I just didn't want to go to Mexico and live, so we got divorced about a year after she left, and in about 1980, and then a year or two later I married Pat. Mm-hmm. And... so I came here, and David Heron hired me. Back in the days when you came in for an interview and it took 20 minutes and you were hired. You know, it was before you had all these committees and stuff. So we came back and started May 1st, 1970. I started working in the Kansas collection here, and then I moved up to work for John Nugent in the archives.
Where were you first?
The Kansas collection, which is downstairs in Spencer Library.
Yeah, okay.
And I worked there for a couple of years and worked on the Wilcox collection, because I was doing a book on the a national, what they call it, for Greenwood Press, a National Union Catalog of left-wing publications.
Well, I saw something about that. Did you know Laird very well?
You know, I didn't know him very well, but when I was the librarian at the University of Missouri, I lent him $300 so he could publish one of his guides, and he never has paid me back for that $300 yet. But
he's now become as conservative as he was
a left-winger.
His wife is a good friend of my daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Carolyn told me that Laird had asked about me, and And you know, well, you know, I didn't really know him. I just knew he had that collection over there, and I knew that it fascinated quite a few of the students because I knew that some of the kind of offbeat stuff that he had, at least you know, offbeat,
right?
By what standards? I don't know.
By middle class standards. I mean, middle class and straight line politicians, you know, political people, Democrats, Republicans.
But you moved up then up to University Arkansas.
Yeah, it was the best thing in the history of my life, you know, moving up there with Nugent. And Nugent and I worked together. You know, we never had one disagreement or one foul thought about one another for the entirety of our career.
He was a very sweet man.
Oh, he was a great man.
Oh, yeah. He was always so good to me. And of course, you know, it was really great, the kind of relationship I was able to have with him, and then with you and Barry.
Yep.
I could call and get stuff over there, and toward the end of the story here, I want to ask you about what the situation is like now.
Yeah.
I know there's some aspects about it I don't like.
Right.
I don't like very
right.
much. Now, what year? See, that would have 1971, And then you went up to the archives.
Went to the archives. Yeah, I came here in 1970, May 1st, 1970, and about 71 I went to the archives and on a full-time basis working for Nugent, and we just started doing it, and it was the greatest job I've ever had. You know, it's this easy, simple job. You know, I think I've since 1972 I indexed every UDK that was ever published.
You did?
Mm-hmm. And the Barry's continuing to do that now, even though they it's online. We're still doing to do it. We index the Journal World and the Topeka papers and the Kansas City Star and the Wichita Eagle too for KU stuff. So, and it's just one of those things that Nugent thought it up, and we all started to do it, and then finally I just started doing it full time because. I just have one of those knack for doing indexing. I ran an indexing service for 1975 until last year, I think, called Access.
Well, you must have amassed a great deal of knowledge and understanding about the university.
Oh, yeah, you do. You know, you tend to forget a little bit of it too, because you you write a story, like you've probably written columns, and you start to write another column. You said, "Man, I think I've written this column before."
Once in a while, I would check back and find that I had written the same thing before.
So after 30 years, it's hard to keep
it. It was kind of embarrassing.
It's inevitable, though. You know, Jim Fisher. He used to work for the Kansas City Star.
Yeah,
Jimmy and I went to school here at KU together. You know, and his brother Mike. So we were all friends here. And
Jim was a friend of mine.
Yeah. Jim was a tremendous writer. I thought he did a great job.
Yeah. I remember he was one who came over from the history department and took my history of American journalism class. So I was always pleased to have a guy like him in there, you know. And we of course I'd worked over on the Star, and I'd gotten to know him when I was over there.
Yeah, he was great character. You know, his dad was an editor for the Star too. Did you know that?
Oh,
journalist
yeah.
on the editorial page too.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, he was a good fella.
Yeah.
Well, tell me some about your work there in the archives. Besides the
UDK and the newspaper indexing.
Yeah.
Well, primarily what we did, Nugent had this theory: you do everything as it comes in, and you do it quickly. And he has that old G.K. Chesterton idea that anything worth doing is worth doing badly, you know. And it's just, it's in the archives is worth doing, and you got to do this stuff quickly, or you're going to get a big mountain of the stuff, and you're not going to get it done at all. And that's the natural tendency for most archivists is to think about it and not do it. So we just started in on just started. It was a laborious deal. In fact, I got two hernias in my career. Barry's had one. John got out of it, but he had all kinds of back problems because it's kind of a manual labor job. You know, there's no intellectual. All you are is a super secretary. You're taking care of all the records of the university, and it's just like being a secretary. And he's got to be a damn good. Papers in file folders, and it's all it really is. And we just created a number for everything. Like for the School of Journalism, the number is 23. So anything 23/0. So anything in the School of Journalism, it goes back in the section called 23, and then we just arrange it chronologically, or under Calder Pickett or John Bremer or whatever. And it's really a very simple situation. And what's amazing about this, it goes against the whole grain of. He's just set up his own system, but it works so well and so it was so simplistic. But it's anathema to what the real archivists do. But it works so smoothly and it works so nicely. And it's like if you called up and you wanted a picture of anybody, you know, of yourself, we could go back and get it just like that. We could just go under, look under 41/0 Pickett, and we could pull out every photograph you have in a matter of seconds.
Well, after John retired, you were in charge, weren't you?
No, sure. No, I'm too much of a maverick to be in charge. They wouldn't put me.
But you seemed to be.
Well, I was. But Sherry Williams was. You know, she was the woman actually in charge. But
when you see, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but she never. They are always. Everybody was intimidated by Nugent, me, and Barry. You know, they seemed to be intimidated. They never gave us any grief because we had a kind of an autonomy. Nugent set up an autonomy. We were an autonomous unit up there for a long time. We always did our thing, and we never went to meetings. In fact, you know, I worked here 33 years, and I don't think I went to 33 meetings in my life. I just didn't go.
You didn't ever have to get involved in.
I just didn't.
Committees.
They wanted you to, but I didn't ever do it. Heck, I just don't want to do it. Nugent didn't ever do it either, so, you know.
No.
He went to a few more than I did. But.
Well, now, did you have an academic rank?
Yeah, I had an academic rank.
What was it?
It was, it's librarian 3, but it's the same, you're tenured. It's a tenured thing. You go through the same tenure committee as the faculty does, but it's not anywhere near as rigorous, you know. The same university committee on promotions and tenure reviews the librarians as reviews the faculty, but it's just one of those perfunctory things for librarians.
Well, you know, I was on that committee on two different terms,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that I had to evaluate people who were
in the library.
Who were in the library? What a librarian 3 would be the equivalent of what?
Oh, probably. I don't know. I mean, that's as high as you can go in a library. You can't, you know, library 1 is like assistant professor,
would
library
rank,
2.
Would it rank as high as a professor?
Oh, probably, but I guess, probably is. I really don't know how they probably think they're that high, but, you know, it's not a demanding job. It's no more, you know, you don't have to. It's the simplest job in the world being a librarian. You get a book, you put it on the shelf, and somebody comes here and you give it to them. Or you get the chancellor's correspondence, you put it on the shelf, somebody comes in and gives it to them. It's an extremely simple job.
Well, I think I've got an article by you in which you have something to say about librarians and how they should rank in the academic.
Oh, right, I did, yeah, a couple of years ago.
Totem pole.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, I wrote that thing just out of a, if we were going through some great changes over at, in a place where I work, and I just went up and one day I said, Barry, I'm going to write this little piece here and let you look at it. I called it The Pity of Professionalism, and I think they changed the name of it, the editors did. I don't know what they call it, but. Original title was Pity.
The tyranny of professionalism. Well, now, what kind of contact did you fellows have with the university librarians?
We didn't have much, you know, really, because we never went to their meetings. They asked us to come, and they kind of wanted us to come, but we just never did. And so we just John was a librarian because he was essentially worked as the. Circulation librarian for decades. He came here, you know, right after World War II, because he was a World War II veteran. He went to school at Emporia, and then he got hired here by Mr. Baker, and then Vosper put him ahead of circulation. He originally came here and worked with old Raymond Hall doing some cataloging of a bunch of natural history books. put him ahead of circulation. He originally came here and worked with the old Raymond Hall doing some cataloging of a bunch of natural history books.
E. Raymond Hall. Well, that would have been one to work with.
One great character. Oh, I got a great story about E. Raymond Hall. We were a friend of mine, Leon Payton, the guy I went to Mexico with. He was doing a photographic essay of the Flint Hills, and E. Raymond was always wanted to have a National Prairie Park. He was a leader of the National Prairie Park Hall had some photographs of Leland's up here on the top floor of Dyke Hall. And one Saturday, Leland came to town. He called up Professor Hall. He got him on the phone and said, "Professor Hall," he says, "So Leland Payton, can I get those photographs?" He says, "Yeah, God dang it," he says, "Payton." He says, "I just cut off two of my fingers on my lawnmower, and I can't get up there for about 2 hours. The doctor said I can't. Got to stay lay low here for about 2 hours." So Payton said, "Okay, I can go to tomorrow." He said, "Oh, no, I'll be up there, meet you in 2 hours. So he went up there, and we got up there, and here was Hall up there, had his hands up in the air like this, and blood was still dripping down his elbow here. You know, he was in there reaching in his pocket, in his vertical file there, pulling out these photographs. You know, he's a tough old coot, old Hall was, you know.
He hated the cans.
Yeah.
And the kids wanted to do a story about Comanche.
Yeah.
So this student went over there, wanted to take a picture of Comanche, and mm-hmm. he said, "No, you can't have it. You can't take one. We won't let you do that." So I went over with him and asked why not. And I said, "Well, you just can't do that." I looked down in the cabinet there, and there was a postcard with Comanche on. So I said, "Okay," I said, "I want to buy this postcard." She said, "No, I can't sell it to you." I said, "Why can't you sell that to me? I'm a member of the public. I have a right to that." Well, she didn't want to, but she did sell me the postcard. And then we just had that postcard copied and had to have a picture of Comanche in the paper. But that was the kind of character he was.
Oh, he was.
Well, believe me, the people I've talked with who were over in his department, every one of them would understand that story.
Sure. I understand it very well indeed. That's typical E. Raymond Hall, isn't it?
Well, you didn't have to deal with the various librarians then.
Not very much. We tried to stay out of their way, and we had such a good go there, Calder. We were just up there by ourselves, and you know, we Barry and I and Nugent, we just, you know, it was like being in a newspaper office back in the old days before everybody had cubicles. You just all sat around and one of those just great things were great camaraderie. It was just one of those great situations of life. And everybody got along.
About the other people there in the building, though? Did you?
No, we didn't get along very well with them. For some, we tolerated them. You know, we were nice, and they and Sandy Mason and I have since become very good friends. But we had a hard time at times.
Sandy's another who must be bitter about something.
Yeah, she's bitter.
I called her to interview her, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yep.
And I don't know, maybe there are things that she's so mad about that she wouldn't want to have them down on paper. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
But, yeah.
I think that's the case.
I think that's the case with a number of people like that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've always gotten along well with the people over there, except they're kind of a law unto themselves. And that is what has happened. And that's what I one of the things I wanted to ask you about. A year ago, I went over there, and I wanted to the anniversary
OKNU
was coming up,
right?
And so I wanted to use the interviews that I had done myself with Jim Seaver and Dick Wright, and Barry told me that the new rule, I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Why can't I? Why can't I borrow those or take those tapes?" I said, "After all, I'm the one who put them here."
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
"No, you can't." And I talked to Sherry Williams about that. "No, that's the policy," and so on.
Yep.
So what I had to do was to bring my own tape recorder over there and put that cassette on and put my own in there and copy the sound that I wanted from those interviews. I'd done. That made me mad as hell.
Yeah, I would be mad as hell.
I just think that is a very capricious
It's ridiculous.
Policy, and this is what's happening now.
Yeah. You know, it's the same thing as happening with the Alumni Magazine photographs, Journal World photographs. It's their records, and even the people at University Relations, you know. We at the archives are essentially a public, a part of the university relations function, you know, and we should be giving that stuff. It's a public service. That's what we do. We let people have that stuff and have it as easily as they, because we deal mainly with journalists, and you know they have a deadline. Anybody in the library doesn't realize what a heck a deadline is. You know, that's the problem. They've never even confronted with a deadline.
Well, you know now why I didn't put my. My radio program.
Yeah, I wouldn't put them in there. I would give them somebody else.
It's in the Moore Archives.
Sure, well, that's a working archive.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
People can come in there and use that
yeah.
stuff, and they do.
Sure. I wouldn't give it to them, honestly.
It would just sit on the shelf
right.
if it were there. Now, you guys used to help me. I remember back in when I was first doing my radio program, I wanted to do an anniversary piece on the assassination of Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone to the convocation, and I remembered that one of the things that we did was to sing the Grand Navy Hymn.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who it was, whether it was John, whether it was you, one of you guys. I went up there, wanted to know whether that convocation had been copied. It had. It
mm-hmm.
was there.
Right. Yes.
And you let me take that tape, and I was able to get for my program the congregation there
right.
in Hoke Auditorium
right.
instead of using a recording. I had a wonderful recording of the Annapolis choir,
right.
something like, but this was the real thing.
Okay.
Well, and that was the way it used to be. And
yeah.
I know that I could go in there and use them. Hell, now I'd have to sign my life away to use things.
Yeah, but it's you know, that's what happens. These guys have two alternatives who are librarians. Either going to be centralized or decentralized, and now the guy pulls out centralization. So we ran great. We ran well on a decentralized system. I like that small autonomous thing because you get to be a. Now you go to a central reference department down there, and nobody knows you. Nobody knows the collection. You know, propinquity is a really important thing for archives. You have to be with the collection that you're dealing with, right up there, in talking to the people who work with that collection every day. A centralized reference person is not going to know diddly squat about that stuff. So it's it just doesn't work for archives.
Well, there are a lot of people who have a very, very bureaucratic attitude about a lot of these things. I have some people over in KNU who don't approve of my copying my program and giving it to people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hell, might as well be used. Otherwise,
sure.
it's gone. And
right.
It's the same way with I let a fellow in the School of Journalism use my. My notes for History of American Journalism, and I let him borrow my slide collection. Well, why not? Otherwise, it's wasted.
Yes, it's ridiculous.
Lost.
Yeah, that's what that stuff's for. I mean, that's what you did, 40 years of your life doing, you know?
Yeah.
You might as well pass it on. That's a great way to pass it on.
Yeah, I'm glad to be able to help people do these things.
Sure, definitely.
Somebody calls me, and I remember a while back a guy called me from, he said, I got your name, I was riding along in my car, and I was listening to a program you were doing about Henry Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been interested in Henry Adams. And I said, well, what's your name and your address? And he told me, and I said, well, I'm going to send you a copy of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I copied a cassette, sent it to him.
Oh, great.
And felt good about it.
Sure. That's good. Yeah, that's what we're here for anyway, to pass this stuff on to other people and make it as easy as possible. You know, you talk to Jennifer Sanner over there at the Alumni Magazine. It's a complicated affair for her and her journalists now to get something out of it. Or Bill Snead to want to get some photographs out of the archives. It's impossible. You know, we used to be able to do it like that. Which is a matter, but now it's a rigmarole. Well, why make a rigmarole out of everything? It used to be simple.
You have to push so many buttons on the telephone to get anything done these days. Ned, I want to ask you about your column you did. Do you still do the column in the
Journal? Well, I don't do it with the Journal World anymore. You know, when you and I and Gurley and a bunch of guys got pinched back, and I got down to once a month, and the Topeka paper called up and asked if I would want to work with them. And I said, yeah, I'm working 1 week a month with the Journal World, and I'll just fill in with you guys. You know, I could do once a week for you, or once every, you know, three columns a month, whatever. And they said, okay. And then the Journal World found out that I was working for them, and they didn't want me to work for them for some reason. You know, I thought they thought it was a kind of a, I guess, competition. So they hired me on when you guys didn't want me, so I'm going to have to stay with them. So I've been working for the Topeka Capital for more than a year now, for about 12 months.
We were going to a basketball game one night, and we got on the elevator. And here come Dolph Jr. and his wife.
Oh, yes.
And she looks at me and she says, I've been wanting to tell you how much I always loved your column, and I've kept so many of them and so on. And Dolph just stood there. He didn't say anything, and I wonder if he knows that my column's no longer in the paper. I thought that was a very interesting thing that happened, that his wife said something like that. But I figured if once a month, to hell with it, I wasn't going to.
Yeah, because you had a heck of a string there for Sundays. So you never missed. I had never missed a Sunday for him either, but you'd been writing a lot longer than.
Well, I started in 88, just after I retired. Bob Nordyke called me and asked me. He'd been one of my students, and he asked me whether I'd be willing to do that.
Yeah, I started in 91 and went to last year.
Yeah. Okay, you're doing the column now for the Daily Capital.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go over there, or you put it on the computer?
We send it just on the email in.
Who do you deal with over there?
Kurt Kaywood, Kurt's Sports Department, right. It's a better deal. They give me more words. You know, the hardest thing in the world is to write briefly, so they give me 1,000 words. Like I was at the Journal World, I was down to 500. And 500, you got to be a... It takes some writing to write 500 words. You have to go over it and over and over. You know, it's always harder for me to be brief than it is to be long-winded.
Well, now, do you ever repeat yourself?
Yeah, I find myself repeating myself. Yes.
Well, now, where do you fish?
I fish primarily Kansas and Missouri, and then I go to Minnesota.
Now, who are you going today?
I'm going to Lone Star Lake this afternoon at 4 o'clock. I'm taking a kid that's... kind of in fishing world, like anything else now, it's become professionalized, and they have professional fishermen. And this guy is a young burgeoning fisherman, and he won a Angler of the Year award in this minor league of tournament fishing. And I've been working with him on a certain technique, so we're going to go out and work on a technique today.
What kind of fish are over there?
We're going to fish for largemouth bass today.
Okay.
Primarily, I try to fish for every species, and because I have to write about it, so I want to fish. I went fishing Tuesday morning with a fellow from Topeka, and we went to Perry Lake, and we fished from 8 to 11, and we had 135 fish. We were fishing for white bass there.
Does your wife go with you?
She goes with me to Minnesota now, and we fish in Minnesota. We just got back Sunday from Minnesota.
Now, where do you fish up there?
We fish up by Grand Rapids now. For years, I fished with Brainerd, Minnesota, because I grew, that's where I was a guide at Nisswa, Brainerd, Minnesota, was a kid from 53 off and on in 1958, actually. I think I said earlier it was 60, but it was to 58.
What was it you liked about fishing?
You know, it's a difficult thing to describe. It's like looking like a Rembrandt painting. You know, you can see it's great. It's like falling in love. You can't quite figure out why. You know, you just know it's a passion, and it's uncontrollable. And it's just something I've tried to explain to people a number of times, and it goes beyond my ability to describe. It's just one of those things that my mind is focused on it frequently throughout the day. You know, I rode my bicycle over here, and I know most of the trip up this damn hill, I was thinking about this fishing trip I'm taking this afternoon. It's always been, it's a preoccupation. It's something.
Well, is it the being outdoors? Or?
Part of that. Part of it is just Just fish.
Do you fish in bad weather?
I try to fish year-round.
My dad used to like to fish when it was raining.
Yep, I like to fish when it's raining. I like to fish when it's snowing. This is the hardest time when it's 100 degrees right now for me, as I get to be an older man. As a young guy, it didn't bother me, but, you know, I'm 63. You know, I'm nowhere near your caliber of manhood. But when I get to, you know, as I've gotten older, it's harder and harder. Weather has a greater effect on me, I got to admit.
My dad fished in the Snake River.
Snake River, great place.
Up near Idaho Falls, yes. Which is not too far from Yellowstone, Teton, and so on.
Wonderful place. It's just a great, it's God's country, essentially. You know, it's a trite thing to say, but it really is wonderful looking, just wonderful place. And when your dad was your dad, it was a heck of a place. You know, it's much different now. It's been probably yuppieized and gentrified.
He never had time to fish much when he was working, because he would work some nights. He'd come home around 7 o'clock and be working all day. And it was after he retired that he really started doing a lot of fishing. And every time we would visit him out in Idaho Falls, he would have some trout for us. And
what did your dad do for a living?
He was a butcher.
Butcher.
Yeah, and a very hard-working man all of his life, you know, he wasn't what you call an outdoor man. He didn't care for hunting at all. We never had a gun in our house.
Yeah, I'm not a hunter either.
But fish, and we used to go fishing. Once in a while, he'd take us fishing in the Bear River. But where we fished, mainly all we could catch was suckers and chubs and carp, which had so damn many bones in them that you could hardly eat them.
Sucker are nice fish, though. Yeah. Sucker, it's a delicious fish, though. Yeah. A sucker really is.
Yeah, I remember when I was a Boy Scout, we went seining for trout, though, up in the rapids of the Bear River, much further up. And this was a wonderful time, I remember, when we did that.
This would be the 30s then, essentially.
I graduated from high school in 39, so it must have been about 45 or 36 or something like that. We did something like that. Is that your main passion, your main hobby, or do you do other things?
Well, yeah, it's my main passion. You know, for years I also ran an indexing service. A friend of mine from the University of Missouri, the library, Gordon Burke, he now lives in Evanston, Illinois, where you went to school as a young man, too. He lives not far from Northwestern. We ran a thing called Access, which we indexed periodicals for years and years and years. And,
well, you're apparently a cook, though, too.
Yeah, I'm a cook.
This is the other article, something I didn't know about your knowledge about that. Of course, you're talking about food now that I'm not supposed to eat.
I don't eat it anymore either. I've actually become friends with my best friend here is Pak Chi Lau. He's a photographer, teaches photography in the design department, and Pak Chi's taught me Chinese cooking, and Pak Chi, and so that's my other passion, is cooking Chinese. Essentially, I cook Chinese. And as I get older, I don't eat meat very much anyway. I just quit eating quite a bit. So I eat a lot of vegetables. I eat a lot of steamed fish. I eat steamed fish about twice a week. In fact, that's what we had last night. We had steamed white bass last night, and going to have some catfish tonight. So
I could eat barbecue spare ribs, though, at least once a week.
Oh, I could. I grew up eating them.
I just love them.
I do, too.
I love that kind of food.
Me, too.
I just do. I love pork.
Yes, I love pork.
I guess that's the fact that more than beef. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't eat beef either. I still eat pork. Pork just tastes good to me. I grew up, my parents ran a barbecue. That's what they did for years. You know, that's the restaurant they started in Sedalia, and so my brother still runs it. So I just have a, you know, barbecue has been in my blood and the smell of hickory. My brother still smells of hickory, and my nephew, you know, their clothes get permeated, but their skin is permeated with that stuff. So it's just part of their life. It's just the smell of food is always just permeates their body.
Do you have children?
Yeah, I have. I have a daughter, Gretchen, who is 40 now. She lives in
40?
Yeah, she lives in Brooklyn. I think she's 40. I think she just turned. She could be 39.
I don't think of you as being that old, but in 1940, well, that's...
Then I have son, John, who is 36. He just moved to next to Urbana, Illinois. He works for the United States Tennis Association. Her daughter, Nancy, who works here at KU, she works in the Institute for Politics. It's the old thing on the top of Bailey Hall, Blake Hall, and they've changed names. It's the James Drury's old place, you know. They change names of that thing so incessantly, hard to keep track of. But she works up there. She's a grant writer for them. She got a master's degree in public administration here with Nalbandian and all those guys that teach up there at that department. Then I have a daughter, Anna, who lives in Austin, who lives now in San Antonio. She's getting a degree in actually public administration from the University of Texas right now. She's 38.
I guess so. I just thought of you as being a lot younger guy, Ned.
I'm an old man, Carter, but I just...
not really. Ned, yeah, but not... What, 40, you're in your
60s. 60s, yeah.
Yeah.
I retired a little bit before I was 65, 63.
Well, you're 82.
I know. I don't want any more days to go by. I just told my wife when I was in Minnesota that I really like being retired, honestly. I like being retired a lot.
Uh-huh.
My job was easy. It was a great job, and it was easy. But I really, being retired and being able just to write a column, and I do a lot of writing because I write for another magazine. It's a great pleasure not to have to write after I come home from work, you know.
Well, now, have you and your wife been able to do any traveling?
We travel a little bit, but my wife still works. She still owns the Raven Bookstore, so she's still pretty active.
She?
Yeah, she's still very active in the bookstore business. So we don't travel yet that much. Yeah, she travels just a little bit more than I do because. Before I retired, because I had this indexing service I was running, and I was writing too at the same time, and then going to KU, so I felt a little bit beleaguered. So it's great to be not working 8 to 5. I love it a lot.
Have you been able to get out in that mountain country that I come from very much?
My grandfather took me out that way. He used to go to the Gunnison River, which is on the west side, and we used to go out there. My grandfather Garstang and. For in the 40s, and then my father took me after that. So we went out there quite a bit, but I really haven't been back since I went to Aspen after I went to Mexico City. So I really haven't been out that way.
Have you ever been up in the Canadian Park?
Yes, I have. Wonderful places.
Isn't that wonderful?
Wonderful places.
We were there last summer. Banff and Jasper.
Yeah, it's just incredibly beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's breathtaking, isn't it? It's just... And it's even after all these years, I went back here not too many years ago, but I was up fly fishing with my father up in Banff. Oh, must have been in about 1957. And it looked the same when we went back here several years ago. It hadn't changed very much at all.
We're going back into the lobster crab country.
Are you?
2 weeks.
Are you?
Yeah, we're going to go back there and get on a. And it's a short cruise that will go to the Martha's Vineyard,
uh-huh.
Gloucester,
mm-hmm.
and all those places. The
mm-hmm.
The Moby Dick country,
right.
what I call it.
Right.
And I'm quite excited about seeing that country back there.
Yeah, but I used to have a friend that lived on Provincetown, and we used to drive there and fish off up in Provincetown out there on the Cape. And usually in August, this time of year, and it was always delightful. I just loved it. We used to stripe bass fish on the surf out there. It was just delightful.
Yeah, we're hoping that there will be some autumn leaves. I don't know. That might be a little early.
I think you're early.
Yeah.
But it's with the ocean keeps it so daggone cool and delightful that it's not. In contrast to anything like this,
I can't stand much more of
this. Yeah, it's 106 today.
It is?
Yes,
oh, my God. It just gets worse and worse all the time, doesn't it?
Yes.
Do you read a lot?
I read a lot. You know, I used to read the New York Times for 5 days a week as a newspaper. And I just stopped here not too long ago. I happened to be watching book notes on C-SPAN, Robert Carroll, the biographer of LBJ, and he's a former journalist, a Newsday journalist, and he says he was talking about, when I start doing this thing, the first thing I do is I go look at all the newspaper accounts of what Johnson was doing. And he says, and I go back and I look and see what the staff memos are and Johnson's papers say and all that. And he said, I wrote some of these stories too myself, and we didn't do it right.
Yeah.
You know, so after that, the New York Times is such a compulsion to read, it just takes more than I can do anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the way I am. I've got, by the time I read the Journal World and the Kansas City paper, my eyes, I can't read as much as I used to.
Yeah. And my wife's in the book business, so I read, but I have dyslexia, so I read laboriously. But I'm reading right now, you know, The Adventures of Huck Finn, and so I read every night, and I read every morning a little bit. But I spend most of my time writing, you know.
Yeah.
And I try to, because it takes me a long time to write. I'm not a quick writer, and in the month of July, I wrote 15,000 words for on magazine stories. So, you know, but it's long and hard, and I don't do a very good job of it.
Have you written for any other sports magazine, anything like that?
I did for small things, for like Field and Stream and Sports of Field, but just kind of briefs type stuff, you know. But the thing I do is for In Fisherman magazine, which is the biggest freshwater fishing magazine. I'm on the field. I'm on the staff now. Then after I retired from here, they gave me a staff position. So, and they gave me six big assignments. So I've been, you know, so it's good. I like to write about fishing, and I just love to write about fishing. So that's what I do, you know. And it's kind of a, I don't know why I like to write about it, and but I just do.
Is your health good?
Good health, yeah. I went to the doctor here the other day, and he says some of my body parts are beginning to wear out on time, but he says other than that, it's just natural. So
yeah,
but it seems like be all right.
Yeah.
I hope I can last like Mickey Ryder did. You know, Mickey used to be up in the archives for years. You know, and damn, old Mick, he hung in there forever. You know, there's a great story about Mickey Ryder that the day he died, Marjorie Ryder called John Nugent up and says, "Mr. Nugent, Mickey won't come and be in work today." And
really?
You know, that's how matter-of-factly people at that age take death. He said he died last night, and John says, "Oh, my goodness gracious, Mrs. Ryder, I'd hate to hear that." "Well, that's all right," she said. He says, "You know, he was quite old man, and he knew it was his time to go."
I went to his funeral, mm-hmm. and Marjorie, who was practically blind, mm-hmm. knew me.
Mm-hmm.
She must have known my voice. I don't know.
Yeah.
Of course, we'd been on the faculty together all those years, and all those people. You know, you're the one that told me to interview Dick Harp.
Dick Harp, right.
Well, you know that damn cuss? He called me, and I've been nagging him for years to get it back to me, and I think maybe that's when he had a stroke or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to call his wife and see whether she has those papers somewhere. Otherwise, it's lost.
And the tape is gone on that thing?
The gal who taped it worked in the law school, and she left here and went to some other place, and the people in the law school didn't know how to get hold of her or whether she even kept the tapes. I have an idea. She just threw her stuff away, so it makes me kind of sick because Dick and I had some good stuff in that interview.
Harp used to come to the archives when he was working on a biography of Fogg, and he would sit around and tell us stories, and he was a great story. I don't know if he could tell them on tape as well as he could, unless he lollygagging after he was working a little bit and tell these stories, but they would make you roll on the floor.
We got some pretty good stuff. His son had been one of my Western Civ students, and we'd gotten to know each other fairly well, and I really liked Dick. And I don't know, he didn't have quite the record of some of the other guys, but I thought he was
a decent man, wasn't he?
He was a damn decent man. Yeah. Didn't you retire a bit early?
Yes, I did. I was, you know, I was.
Were you tired of
it? It was a great, easy job, but I'd worked in the library for 33 years at the same thing, and I just, if Nugent was here, I would have stayed on, you know, but the place was going downhill, essentially, I thought, you know, and I know Barry's got 5 more years, and he's kind of dreading it too, because it wasn't a great place. It was a fun place. It was just a good fun place, and we tried to make it, people have a good time when they came up to.
Love to come up there. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't.
I think it's a hard place.
I call and talk to Barry, but I don't want to tangle with those other people up
sure.
there. I don't.
Yeah.
Of course, I think that. I think this is the university these days.
Yeah, it's a whole bunch. It's run by bureaucrats, essentially. You know, I mean, they always have a tendency to be bureaucratic. That's just the nature of the folks who run a thing. But it's more so than it ever has been. And there's just, you know, it's just a line of bureaucracy. You can't believe the minutes of meetings that pile up over in the decades.
That had a lot to do with my retirement.
Sure, it's just bizarre.
I got tired of being on committee meetings where I didn't know what I was doing.
Sure.
Where I had no interest, and I knew there was somebody who could do a better job there.
Sure.
That and some of the politics that were starting to emerge here, and the school of journalism and in the university. And I got an invitation yesterday to the dedication of the new Kansas Public Radio facilities, and I can't figure out why that invitation came from Chancellor Hemingway and one of the Menningers. I figure it should have come from Janet Campbell or somebody like that. I'm not going to be here at that time, so I won't be able to attend that. But I don't know. That kind of bugged me. I don't know. That's the way everything.
Sure.
Everything done around
right.
here these days.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, has this been a good place for you to live?
Great place. Yeah, it's been a great place. I don't want to live anyplace else. Essentially. I'm happy.
You don't want to go back to Missouri?
No, I'm fine.
Do you fish over in Missouri?
I do. I'm going over Sunday to fish. I'm fishing.
That's a great commercial they've got that shows on television mm-hmm. about
yes.
whether you really know Missouri and so mm-hmm. on. Because I know there's some marvelous places in
sure.
that state. You know,
yeah, I'm going actually. I'll be Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I'll be over in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going over there more often, but my brother fishes, and so does one of my nephews. So I go over and fish with them every Easter. We get together and have a family fishing affair, mm-hmm. and every Thanksgiving we do. So
yeah, we don't take the interstate.
I hate them too.
Anymore. We go up on. Well, this time we're going to take 24
mm-hmm.
across. Usually we take 36, but if you get behind one old guy in a van who's driving 30 miles an hour. And is holding up everybody, then going into Hannibal, and that's not a good way to be traveling.
Yeah.
So we'll see what 24 is like. I don't know.
We just came back from Minnesota. We travel on Interstate 35 occasionally, but we came back on Highway 15 and 69, and it's such a great joy to go through those small towns and go easily. The truck traffic and the noise is incredible on those interstates, and I just don't like it. I don't like the pace.
The only problem that I miss is the rest areas,
yes.
which I badly need.
Sure. Yeah. As our age progresses,
I've got to have those, and so and it is nice when you're on the.
Yeah.
Ned, I think we've covered about.
Well, great. Caller, it's been great.
About
great,
most of it.
Great reminiscent with you about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this because you're a guy I always liked, and I figured that we could have a good.
Yeah, it's fun just jawing here a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.